A very good example of the influence of the model of spiritual guide that we have seen on what might be called the consciousness and practice of people who were not professional philosophers or professionally involved in religion is provided in the writings of the physician Galen, who lived from around 124 to around 200 AD, or perhaps a little later than that. Galen is a remarkable figure in his own right as a physician and surgeon, one might even say as a psychiatrist. He originally trained in medicine and then practiced, came from a fairly wealthy family, so he was well educated, and in that sense he was exceptional as physicians went, and I'll explain that in just a moment. He received real anatomical information and experience by working with the gladiators of Pergamon. He then was eventually called to Rome to become the court physician of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius and remained in Rome pretty much for the rest of his life and left behind a huge corpus of medical writings that came to be regarded as standard texts throughout the Middle Ages right down until the 16th century. He made some anatomical errors because it was very difficult, if not illegal, for him to dissect human cadavers, and so as a consequence some of his animal models were incorrect, and he tended to be criticized for this in modern times. But his observations and his willingness to engage in what we would today call physiological experimentation was tremendously advantageous and tremendously effective, and left behind a very powerful body of material that was useful. Now, we'll be looking at his philosophical reflections, which concern more his concern about, as he puts it, the cure and healing of the passions of the soul, which to him are a kind of an equivalent of the diseases of the soul. So as a physician, he's looking at what we would today call psychiatric or emotional illnesses, and he's trying to find ways of approaching them, ways of understanding and treating them. And one of them, borrowing from the model of classical philosophy, and he's clearly trained in the tradition, particularly of Plato and Aristotle, is to look at philosophical insights and traditions and to use them and to apply them in what he would consider to be a more medical or clinical context. If you look at the little timeline that I've provided, you can see that Galen is living in at a time of relative peace in the Roman Empire, one of the few eras where there's a succession of fairly balanced emperors from Hadrian through Marcus Aurelius, but he also then lives through to the accession of Marcus Aurelius' son Commodus, and the ongoing deterioration of the empire after that period. But Galen lives in a period during which it's possible to write and to leave behind a considerable corpus based on careful reflection and access to sources. One might mention that in his era, the profession of being a physician, of being a doctor, was in no sense as socially reinforced or regarded as positively as it is today. The overwhelming majority of physicians were freedmen, that is, people who had been slaves originally, and who were itinerant, that is, they traveled from place to place. They were also held in not very high esteem because they often quarreled and fought with one another. This is the reason for specific admonitions against this in the Hippocratic corpus. And Galen is, for that reason, very much an exception, a person who has a high position of authority, who is paid to engage in research and in reflection, and who can bring together any number of models and of traditions. Let's look at the text itself on his diagnosis and cure of the soul's passions. He, at the very first paragraph, talks about this desire to cure the passions of the soul, mentions the fact that Aristotle and Plato have already written on this subject, and he will quote them and other philosophers regularly in this text. And then he says in chapter 2, and we'll be following the numbering at the beginning of the sections, which is in a kind of a dark red. He says, "Whoever wishes to be good and noble must consider that he cannot fail to recognize many of his own errors." One of the chief things that Galen will be reminding us of is that this project of self-improvement, of being cured of the excesses or the passions, we might say the sins or the addictions of the soul, is something you cannot do alone. You require the assistance of someone who can objectively assess your situation. And he is, in the next paragraph, gives this lovely story derived from Aesop, of the man who has two sacks suspended from his neck. One is in front, which is filled with the faults of other people, and that we constantly see, and the other one is behind, containing our own faults, and that we don't see. He says, we see the faults of others, but remain blind to those which concern ourselves. And I've added in blue a reminder that you find this same story again in an adapted form in the Apothegmata Patrum, the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, exactly the same model of a little bag of sand before and behind one that stand for one's own sins and the sins of the brethren. So this is a very powerful story, a reminder that we are often blind to our own faults, and therefore we require the assistance of an other. The spiritual guide that Galen will particularly recommend is an intelligent and honest friend or acquaintance, someone who will speak to us about what they actually see. So Galen goes on to say, both Aesop's Phelim and Plato's Maxim, quoting Plato, who says that we are blind to that which we love, and of course we love ourselves. We can't escape from self-love. We have this problem of not being able to clearly see our own faults. And so if you drop down then, I've put my own little comment in a blue bar. To see ourselves truly, we need a trusted other. And this begins chapter 3 of this works. How can we cut off these passions unless we know that we have them? It's impossible to know them since we love ourselves to excess. And so he says, find someone who will be honest. Whenever you hear of someone who might be able to do this for you, associate with that person, determine whether or not they really are living a life of virtue themselves, are they disciplined, and then, dropping down into that highlighted paragraph, if you find such a man, summon him, talk with him one day in private, ask him to reveal whatever of the above-mentioned passions he may see in you, tell him you will be grateful, and that you will look upon him as your deliverer more than if he had saved you from an illness of the body. This is a common issue that one finds recounted even in the lives of the saints. Particularly, there are examples of people who became bishops and who had to seek out friends reminding them that in the past people were willing to tell them their faults, but from now on people would be less likely to do that. This is a perennial problem, and Galen is reminding us that friendship, an honest friendship, or a spiritual guide, or friend who can serve as a spiritual guide, is absolutely essential. Then he gives some examples of how you should interact with this person, how you should regard them in the next two or three paragraphs. And again, please come back and look at this at your leisure. Dropping down toward the last paragraph in number 3, so let all tell you what fault they find with you. Do not be angry with anyone. So once you've learned the ability to listen to this friend, this counselor, this spiritual guide, who's able to tell you what they see in you, and you're able to hear it, then you can do this with all sorts of people. Listen to what other people say, and don't be angry. Let other people, especially those who have led excellent lives, be your teachers. We'll see this same model of learning coming up in the life of Antony of the Desert, where he learns from the people of his own parish, of his own town, how to live a life of virtue. This is, again, a classical admonition, as we're seeing, but something that was regarded as very practicable. You begin by listening to another person who tells you honestly what they say and think about you, and then you develop the capacity to listen to everyone in your community who, of those in your community who you have reason to believe can have valuable opinions that could be useful for you. He then goes on in number 4 to point out that we should go on and commit ourselves to doing this, and it will take a long time. It's the process literally of a lifetime. Remember, this was one of Ilsetro's, Hedo's principles, that one has to be willing to commit oneself to this project for the course of a whole lifetime. And he points out, Galen is pointing out, that this can take several years. How do you begin this training, he asks in section 5. Well, the first step is refraining from anger, refraining, he says, from punishing a servant who has done wrong, refraining from doing that with your own hands. So you begin in a practical way, trying to avoid giving in to angry expressions, expressions of angry behavior. And then if you drop down a little further to a numbered, indented series of paragraphs, he says that what you are supposed to do is you must every morning consider your daily tasks, reminding yourself that you don't want to be a slave to your passions, to your we might call them emotional addictions or compulsions. Second, you have to seek out someone who will help you. You can't do this alone. And third, you have to keep this before your mind every day and every hour, that we are very much in need of others to assist us in this project. There's a continual recollection of the need for change that has to go on throughout the whole of one's life. Dropping down about three paragraphs further to an indented series in a slightly different kind of a background, we're not to relax our vigilance for a single hour. We must listen to the advice or the accusations that come from everyone. We must listen in a gentle spirit and show gratitude to those who show us what we need to change, to those who, as he puts it, rebuke us. So an attitude of gratitude toward those who provide an opportunity for change is essential. Then in chapter 6, he goes on to describe specifically what he feels are, and he gets this straight from Plato primarily, but also from Aristotle, what are the parts of the soul that need to be healed. They are the irascible and concupiscible powers. Plato had described this in several treatises as the charioteer with the two powerful horses, the powerful horses of, on the one hand, the irascible capacity, the capacity to become righteously indignant, to rise up in defense when danger threatens, on the one hand, and the other great horse, the other winged steed that pulls our chariot up towards heaven, is our desire, our longing. But both of these can be misused. Anger can lash out at those whom we ought to be compassionate towards, and desire can deteriorate or degenerate into lust. So there has to be, as he puts it, a cultivation of obedience in the case of our irascible, our defense-providing portion of our souls, and then he says the chastisement of the concupiscible power. This is a couple of paragraphs down and highlighted. The chastisement of the concupiscible power consists in not furnishing it with the enjoyment of things it desires. Frugality, willingness not to give in to the things that we want. So, these are the two, as he calls them, as Plato called them, irrational powers, not meaning that in a negative or deprecatory sense, but that these are not the intellective, thinking, analyzing, intuition-oriented powers. These are the parts that are powerfully energizing of the soul, and we have to be engaged in the process of healing or allowing them to be healed. Then if you drop down a little further to some indented and numbered paragraphs against a slightly more yellow background, number one, we must entrust the diagnosis of these passions to others. We cannot know our own spiritual illnesses clearly. Second, the people we trust must be older people, considered to be good and noble. Number three, we must show them gratitude. And then he says, and this is very interesting, remember Hadope reminded us that there was a tradition in classical antiquity of keeping a record, a note of one's failings and the things that one needed to change, and sharing these with one's spiritual guide. Well, here, for Galen, the spiritual helper is primarily pointing out our deficiencies, and we are reminding ourselves of the things we need to change. He says two or three times each day. We are to do this at dawn, before beginning our daily tasks, and toward evening, before resting. Now, remember, of course, in the Christian tradition, this will manifest itself as particular times of prayer, of committing or commending oneself to God, and eventually also of meditating on the scriptures, of being aware of the commandments and praying the Lord's Prayer in particular. So here you have in classical antiquity a three times daily meditation on what needs to be changed in the soul. You can see how this, present in the ethos in which Christianity is already developing, will naturally mingle with the tradition of prayer and acquire a spiritual significance within the Christian tradition. And he says that he's become accustomed, Galen has been accustomed, to ponder twice a day the exhortations of Pythagoras, which he has written. In other words, he's meditating what he regards as an ethically and maybe even spiritually or religiously helpful text. He recites it to himself, in effect memorizing them, putting them into his heart. So, he says, we also then, and in the next paragraph it's highlighted, we strive to surpass those who earnestly pursue this great virtue of temperance, this great virtue of self-discipline, and we want to surpass others and ourselves, engage in a kind of a holy rivalry in regard to acquiring this virtue of self-control. So this is a theme that we will also see in Saint Benedict and elsewhere, a holy zeal, a good zeal, which eventually can actually lead us to God. If we drop down to chapter 7, he gives a recapitulation, a kind of a restatement of his recommendations, and I've numbered them, and you'll see some blue highlighted text, which is my own. That blue highlighted text is not in the original. It's something I've given just as a kind of a summary. The first is, again, this is a recapitulation of what he's already said. We look at others as examples, and we see both the good and the bad, and that teaches us, but we have to retain a certain humility in regard to ourselves. We have to recognize that what we see in others, we also have in ourselves, reminding Plato's admonition that we are blind in regard to our own self-love. Therefore, we need an honest spiritual guide. This is his third principle. We need to be grateful for this friend, this honest individual's explanation of what he sees in us. And then, number five, we have to be willing to discipline ourselves, to regard ourselves, to look within ourselves, to meditate, as he says, multiple times per day on what needs to be changed, and maintain, in number six, a constant vigilance within the self. In chapter 8, he tells his own story that his father, who was primarily trained in geometry, architecture, astronomy, arithmetic, not in philosophy, liked to use geometrical demonstrations, and so his father gave him a few little maxims to meditate on, and I've highlighted and indented several of those. Not to be hasty in claiming to be a member of one tradition or sect only. That number two, that we have to seek constantly the four classical virtues of justice, temperance, fortitude, and prudence. And then third, that we have to practice a serenity, an inner quietness, an inner ability not to be ruffled by events. And his father, he says, also didn't have any interest in glory or honor as far as other people were concerned, but his only esteem was for the truth. And this is something that Galen himself practices or seeks to practice. Now, that's as much as we're going to look at from this document. We'll look very briefly now at another text, Galen's treatise on the doctrines of Plato and Hippocrates. And in this writing, in this text, which is a very long text, I've selected a section in which he, as a physician, explains his rationale for what we would have to call music therapy. If you drop down and look at the text, in the first three paragraphs, he gives his explanation, kind of a recapitulation of the notion of an irrational part or an irrational part of the soul that needs to be healed. And then he says, this is highlighted, we shall prescribe for some persons a regimen of rhythms and scales and musical exercises of one kind, and for other people, another sort of exercise, because as Plato said, we have to rear the dull and heavy and spiritless and high-pitched rhythms and scales that move the soul forcibly, and those who are too high-spirited and rush about madly need to be given, as he says here, music and a kind of music therapy, a regime of music that will help calm their souls. So he believed that there was this interrelationship between music and the state of the health of the soul, and he gives an example of it in the last paragraph of someone who was advised to change the kind of music that she was playing because the young men who heard her were becoming rather irrational and inappropriate. And so what we have in Galen is a kind of visible exterior recommendation of precisely the precepts that we saw Haddo telling us were found in classical antiquity. And remember, Galen is not a professional philosopher. He is what we would today call a scientist. And even for him, the principles of spiritual guidance are very important for what one might call the hygiene or even the medicine of the soul. One needs another to tell one what is going on. You have to practice vigilance in regard to your own interior life. You have to meditate on certain precepts regularly and make them a part of yourself. You have to take note of the ways in which you have failed, and you have to make use of appropriate regime and what he would call treatment methods, which for him include an appropriate form of music.